Welcome to the Debt-Free Mom Podcast. Today on the podcast, we have a very special guest with us. Shung Saavedra is here, and she is the founder and CEO of Save My Sense, which is an influential personal finance website and social media platform. I've been following her for a while and love everything that she shares. She teaches readers the key habits and behaviors needed to become less fearful about money and live their life with joy. She received her bachelor's degree in economics from Harvard and her MBA from the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Saavedra and her husband finished saving for their retirement by the age of 31, and they now live a work-optional life in Southern California with their two boys and their two cats. So, Shung, welcome to the Debt-Free Mom Podcast.
Thank you, Carly, so much for having me. So excited.
So you wrote a book, and that's why we get to talk together, called Wealth is a Mindset. And what made you choose that title? I'm curious about that.
Funny enough, ChatGPT was no help at all, but it did give us like 25 to 30 ideas. But at the end of it, my publisher and I kind of conferred, and she's like, you talk about something that other people don't. You're not focusing on the numbers. You're focusing on people's feelings and habits, and all of that is rooted in mindset. And then so Wealth is a Mindset, which actually was a one-off kind of slogan that I had for my Instagram, became the title of the book.
Amazing, amazing. So you are now, as I read in your bio, you're work optional, you're a mom of two, you have an MBA, you have all of these letters behind your name, all these accolades. What happened in your young adult life as you went through college and beginning your career that made you realize this truth, that wealth is a mindset, that it's not a number, that you couldn't earn your way into that? What are some of those things that happened early on that made you realize this?
In my early 20s, I was actually living out this high school nerd revenge fantasy because I was bullied so much as a child. I was like, well, you know what? Being little and not looking great and not being popular, I think my revenge is going to just be filthy rich. And that was the original drive that got me to college. And through my early years, I was like, just get rich, and you're going to show your bullies. Well, as it turns out, that's not exactly a very sustainable way to live life emotionally. First off, I forgot who my bullies were. I'm like, I don't even know their names at this point. How am I going to, you know, tell them that I made it? And second, it didn't make me any happier to pursue life with kind of this like more like TV ready definition of like what wealth is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And it all came to a head when my husband and I got married and we agreed, hey, eventually we want to be parents, but it's going to be financially a step up. So why don't we learn to live off of the lower of our two incomes now so that we can have this breathing room ready by the time we do become parents? We agreed to this, but we agreed to this while living in the heart of New York City, which is not an easy feat. My husband naturally just knew how to be frugal, but I had to pare back my nice-to-have expenses. And by trying to do so, I kept not meeting the agreed-upon budget each month. And I was like, I guess I'm just bad at budgeting. Like, I literally just used that phrase in my diary. And I kept thinking, you just got to get better, just track more, just get better at your math, analyze more. And none of that was working. And finally, I realized, oh, wait, actually, it's your attitude. It's your mental health. That's what's making it hard for you to become more frugal. And once that was the realization, things got a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is, it's such a helpful realization because you were, like you talk about in the book, you were a very young, high earner. So you had, for what many people would say, everything at your fingertips in terms of that income, that dual income, no kids, that thing that, you know, is so elusive to many people. But because of the budget that you had established, it was creating, I think, a big dissonance between what the numbers said and how you felt, which I think is something that people at some point or another have that realization of these numbers look a certain way and the way I feel looks an entirely different way.
Exactly. I was miserable, even though numbers-wise, I shouldn't be. And I realized, wait, you're actually the one in control of your emotions, and you have to do the changes necessary to realize that.
Yeah. So you have a statement in the book where you say, change your mind and change your life. And as I was reading that, I was thinking about times where I have tried to change everything except my mind. Like, if I could just build the best looking spreadsheet, I will spreadsheet my way out of this. Or if I can sell one more thing on Facebook Marketplace, then I'll be able to do this thing. And so that statement in your book really hit me, because it is true that if I change everything else except my mind, then I'm not actually making any changes. I'm just trying to cope or get by in order to achieve something. But it is generally a method that has these negative consequences down the road. It might feel good in the short term, but then it has some long-term consequences that I don't exactly want to deal with. So as we talk about the idea of changing our mind instead of just changing our numbers, that we can't just build wealth by saying, okay, as long as I make a budget and continuously increase my income, the cards will just fall in nice places for me. I instead have to change my mind as well. You list three main root causes of money problems, and I want to dive into those before we then talk about our main topic of this spending cycle. So the three that you list in the book are feast and famine, adverse events, and scarce immigrant. So if we could just go through each of those one by one and describe for listeners, because I think everyone will identify in some way with at least one of these. So I'd love to just lay the groundwork for what you talk about fully in the book. What is this feast and famine root cause?
Yeah. And like you said, people are going to identify with one, two, or all three. And that's because these were created based on my research into the hundreds of coaching clients that I have who come to me and say, Sean, I'm bad at money, or I just never learned personal finance. And then I realized many of them had all of these stories in their lives. So feast and famine is a play on the phrase feast or famine. And it speaks to the fact that you likely grew up in a household where your parents could not or did not budget. And then so when there was money, they spent it. And then when there was no money, they went into debt. It's very unstable. You feel like you're just constantly going between having something and not having something. Consumer debt, credit card debt, super, super common. And while not always the case, most likely it's also because your parents were likely low income, making it hard for them to have any savings to speak of, which would then lead them to want to plan ahead.
Yes. I think of this pendulum swing of, if our perspective on our money is very short term on how much money is in my checking account today, and that determines what our spending habits are, that it leads to wild fluctuations. We wake up, we log into the bank account, and we're like, oh, the paycheck hit. We can go here, kids, and we can order this online, and we can go out to this. And then as soon as that dwindles away, because those normal bills come in and get withdrawn, then all of a sudden that same parent flips a complete 180 into nobody buy anything and don't go anywhere. And any sort of instability like that really affects a child, especially, who can't really wrap their minds around what's actually happening. And so that feast and famine of experiencing both of those things inside one household, sometimes within a day, let alone within a week or within a month, can make you feel unstable then as an adult as well.
Yep. So if you are a child who grew up in feast and famine, because you did not see planning ahead from your parents, you also likely in your adulthood would be very impulsive with your own spending. So even if you have a lot of income coming in, and I do coach a lot of people who are six-figure, multi-six-figure earners, similar to parents, spend it when you get it. Whenever you see something you like, you're going to put that on the card, just mirroring what you were shown as a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wrote down, it's that lack of impulse control also leads to then seeking that next happiness hit, that we find our happiness in that next purchase or that next order. And so then as that dwindles, because we've put so much happiness riding on those purchases, as that goes away, then our happiness is also fluctuating in line with whatever our bank account fluctuations happen to be.
Yeah.
Okay, the second one is adverse events. And so can you describe what does that look like in childhood related to money? And how does that then translate into an adult who's trying to manage their money?
Yeah, the inspiration for adverse events actually came from a scientific study that followed children throughout, and it saw that if they had adverse events as a child, it also leads to negative physical medical outcomes. In the world of personal finance, I define adverse events as you growing up with your parents or guardians using money and resources as a way to control you and make their love for you conditional. Mm. Whereas in feast and famine, I actually say most feast and famine parents are actually still very caring parents. Mm-hmm. Like they do want to love on their children. In adverse events, that love only depends on you meeting some very unreasonable standard. It could be looks. It could be your academic achievement, your behavior, athletics. But something about you apparently is wrong. And until you reach that standard, your parents are not going to even give you some of the basics, which is extremely traumatizing. It teaches you as a child that apparently you're not worth anything unless you meet some valid standard. What this does in adulthood is that when you're taught over and over again that you are nothing unless you meet some goal, then as an adult, you're unable to identify yourself through loving yourself. You're always going to be looking for external validation, looking to meet a standard, winning a prize, whatever. And I call all this activity identity seeking behavior. When it comes to money, let's say you were told that you have to look a certain way as a child, then you might be spending a lot on clothing and skincare, makeup, aesthetic treatments. If academic achievement was the measurement when you were young, your identity seeking behavior might just be throwing yourself completely into your career, regardless of whether it is a toxic career or not. And for people who suffered the worst sense of abuse as a child, I mean, adverse events does include abuse. As an adult, you may also just not have a lot of care for your life, and this can and sometimes leads to substance abuse.
Mm-hmm. I think it's such an important conversation, such a heavy, important conversation to specifically identify those things that happened in our childhood. I think a lot of times when someone experiences that, when they get to adulthood and they no longer live with that person, or they're no longer, you know, in contact with that situation, they think, okay, now I can just move past it. But a lot of times it's that is precisely when they actually need that licensed professional help to then work through.
Yeah.
Maybe even if you experienced it 20, 25 years ago, how is that showing up in your life today? And so I think it is so important to identify that we sometimes can't make those one-to-one connections of the way I was treated when I was 5 is now making me have these financial issues when I'm 35, right?
But exactly.
Getting that professional help too, to see those perspectives, can then help to work through how are those root causes something that I am able to break free from, that I can move past and behave differently. I'm not pigeonholed into this is my plot in life because of what happened in my childhood. And I think it is important for people maybe identifying in that adverse events category to ask for that professional help of the way that it shows up in your life. Even if they aren't specifically talking about money, the things that they can do to help you work through that will then have positive effects on your money.
Exactly. Your brain needs to heal. Mm-hmm. And if your brain is not healed, it's just going to repeat what it was taught as a child, which is why so many people's adulthoods are just mirror images of what their parents were doing when they were children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the third one is scarce immigrant. Tell us about that one.
Yes. I'm also very excited to actually talk about immigration, because I myself, as an immigrant, came to the United States at age 10, and I grew up with my parents thinking, oh my gosh, we must be the poorest people in this town, because we live in a tiny house and everything. So the story, which I think echoes across most immigrants coming to richer countries like the U.S., is that your parents gave up everything for the hope, not the guarantee, the hope of a better future for them and for you. And they left behind, this is the biggest risk of their lives, they leave behind their own parents and siblings, most likely, their culture, which is huge, language in many instances. For me as a Chinese person, their food, leaving behind the food is always traumatizing. And everything they knew, they come to a new country, oftentimes with little money, get established. And so when they go through so much, they don't want their kids to do the same. So the parents, in turn, in their language to their children, is going to be like, don't do what we did. You go and get educated, get a better job. Do the safe thing. Don't do what we did. And oftentimes in immigrant households, children are pressured to take a very safe, quote unquote, guaranteed path like become a doctor or like a lawyer or a computer scientist for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
And while this actually does lead to a lot of immigrant children of immigrants having very high paying jobs, like I do coach a lot of doctors and tech workers, and this is very much their childhood. They grow up being risk avoiding because their parents told them to avoid
mm-hmm.
risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see this risk avoidance in personal finance where people don't put themselves out there for a better job or a better work environment because they're like, well, this is what I know. This is safe. Or they might not choose to invest their money and take on the risk of investing. I've seen people literally sit, and one of the examples in my book, somebody sat on more than $100,000 sitting in a bank, but not even knowing what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And it's because they're really, really afraid of taking any risk with their career, with their money. And that is also super fascinating because it's like sometimes you actually do need to take a little bit of risk to, mm-hmm. to add more growth and wealth to your portfolio. But your parents kind of keep you on this locked path
mm-hmm.
Because of the way they spoke about risk in general.
Yeah, I think it was really helpful you described too that they want their wealth to be more tangible, that they often do things like buying a home instead of investing in the stock market because they can see the house and that's a physical manifestation of their money. And the stockpiling cash is probably similar, that it feels accessible and safe and it's not, the amount in that account is not going down. It comforts them, I think is the word that you use, and it feels comfortable to have those things that they can see. And it makes perfect sense to me that you wouldn't trust something like a foreign country's stock market if you don't understand it. Why would I give my money to something like that? That makes very much logical sense to me. I can understand how that would be the reaction when moving to a new country and trying to
yeah.
understand even just the most basic things, like you said, of the language and how do I get my driver's license. So to go even up to higher levels like investing can just feel so, so risky.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So in that scarce immigrant mindset, one thing you mention in that section is that having a scarcity mindset is different than being frugal. Can you describe
yeah.
that a little bit?
Because it's so common for immigrant households to not have a lot of wealth. Frugality or growing up with low costings is almost like it's almost present in all immigrant families. And so oftentimes I'll have adults come to me and say, oh, I'm scarce because I'm frugal. And I'm like, I'm frugal too,
mm-hmm.
but I've got a lot of abundance in my life. And then so when I tried to split the two meanings, I realized people conflate the two. And I was like, you can be intentionally frugal, but still choose to take risks mm-hmm. with your money. And that actually makes you very abundant.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you could be spending a lot of money, you know, buy expensive things, but then choosing not to take any risks. That's what makes you scarce. So that's why I reframed it from how do you spend your money more to how much risk are you willing to take mm-hmm. with your money?
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful distinction of that frugality has intention behind it of like you have found things that you value. And so spending less on things that you value less allows you to put money more towards something that you value more, where that scarcity, I think, takes a holistic approach to it's indiscriminate in how it tries to limit where the money goes, regardless of if it's something that you feel like you value or not.
Exactly.
If you're not paid once a month, why are you budgeting that way? A monthly budget ignores the fact that sometimes your expenses are due before the next paycheck is available. A pay period budget is built around your unique pay schedules so that your money doesn't feel like a mess. Create an accurate, realistic plan for getting the most out of each paycheck. Get started budgeting by pay period today with the best-selling budget template and mini course from me, Debt-Free Mom. It's available for just $9 at debtfreemom.co/template. I spent years feeling frustrated that my money wasn't working the way it should. It wasn't until I discovered the magic of budgeting by pay period rather than by month that my money started to feel stable. Pay Period Budget Academy is my signature budgeting course that helps hundreds of women take control of their home finances. Join today at debtfreemom.co/PBA and use the code PODCAST at checkout to get 20% off your membership. So these three things are boiling below the surface. Maybe right now is the very first moment that someone had a definition behind how they felt or a name behind how they felt. And those things, those are root causes that then manifest themselves in the way that we work and spend mm-hmm. and buy and save and invest. So in your book, you talk about this cycle, and I love how you give visuals. I'm a very visual person. I loved all the graphs in the book. This cycle of trigger, action, and reward, and that we're mm-hmm. all going through that cycle as we are interacting with our money and using our money. And so how can we use these three, if someone's listening and has identified that they most relate to feast and famine, how can we use understanding that to think about this trigger, action, reward?
The best way to describe a trigger is that it's a pressure point in your life. It could be pressure from an ongoing situation. Divorce and separation is actually a very common one. Emotions, strong emotions like anger, sadness, loneliness, stress, just to name a few. And when your brain is under pressure, it often does not have the ability to think straight. I mean, like that, I've experienced that absolutely when I went through postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety. When your brain does not think straight, it goes into essentially a comfort zone. It's like, what can it do on automation? It's like your brain kind of goes on autopilot. And for most of us who have not addressed our childhood root issues, our root causes, our autopilot means we repeat what we were taught as a child. So to put it in concrete examples, for a feast and famine person, when you're under pressure, you ultimately are trying to move away from that negative state by spending on yourself to make you feel good, right? And then so let's say you got really stressed out at work, you get an ad for this beautiful item or this item that, you know, supposedly will solve all your problems in your kitchen. You're like, oh, I just want to feel better. So you buy that item and you temporarily feel better because it does feel nice to have a nice, shiny, you know, Amazon delivery at my door. But if you haven't addressed your long-term issue, over time, if you keep on being impulsive, your spending is going to add up and potentially put you into debt. Mm-hmm. For an adverse event, so let's go back to the person who was told to meet a certain aesthetic growing up. Somebody told you you're not doing well at work. So it's crushing your identity of, okay, I'm not meeting some standard in my life. So that's your trigger. And then you're going to be like, okay, I have to show that I'm better than this. And if you were brought up kind of like being pressured to look good, you're like, okay, I'm just going to look better. And then so your action is that you're probably going to spend on something aesthetic, like call it another skincare set. Mm-hmm. And your temporary reward is, okay, you have addressed the aesthetic part, but you have not addressed the underlying issue, which is how can you react to bad news at work? Mm-hmm. The third one, scarce immigrant, and this happens a lot with a lot of the scarce immigrants that I've met. Like, take the current environment right now. It is scary. We don't know what's going on with the government. Things are changing. Stock market is reacting, you know, in ways that are not great. So let's say somebody sees all this negative news. It's triggering to them. And as a scarce immigrant, you want to avoid risk. You want to feel safe. The person who wants to feel safe, they're probably going to squirrel more money into their bank account instead of investing. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes turbulent times are actually the best times to invest for the long run because you might get great stuff at a discount. And then so the scarce immigrant puts away money, feels safe for the time being, short-term reward, but long-term, they haven't done anything to actually build wealth in a meaningful way, which then would help them feel better regardless of whatever is going on in the economy.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important too to recognize, you mentioned it in the book, that these are self-perpetuating, that if we keep doing them, then the internal dialogue we have is, oh, it felt good to buy that thing when I was stressed. And so next time I'm stressed, I know somebody who was a psychologist talked about thinking of the brain as having these grooves in it, that the more we go down these habit paths, the smoother the groove gets, and it makes it easier to take that groove the next time and harder to jump out of that groove. And so yeah, we have to recognize that as we are doing it over and over, it's actually making it more likely for us to do it the next time, even though in a moment of clarity between those two triggers, we probably recognize that there was some sort of long-term harm to making that choice.
Making that connection is the hardest part, because I've heard from a lot of people who read my book, they're like, I've never seen my spending described like this. It's like, okay, well, that actually makes a lot of sense, Sean. But nobody has been telling other people, like, this is actually how your spending is working. Because on the surface, it looks very different. Like, when people tell me, oh, I have a debt problem, I have a money problem, you think the problem is money. But the actual root cause of all of this is something deeper. I often say your money problems are the symptom. And the actual quote-unquote diagnosis or whatever disease you have, I wouldn't call it a disease. I didn't mean it in that way. It's deeper. Yes. And we got to dig deeper to find it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you can see what you're buying. You can see where your money is going in a much quicker way than you can see the logical pathway that your brain's taking to arrive at that choice.
Exactly. Yep.
So if we can identify that trigger, action, reward, and see how that negative cycle is perpetuating itself and showing up in our own spending, which part of that trigger, action, or reward do we need to focus on changing?
Yes, it's the action part. Your triggers are actually never going to go away. I know it's really awful. And for some time in my own personal finance journey, I actually tried to remove the triggers in my life. I'm like, I'm going to not be on social media. I'm going to not hang out with friends. I don't want to get like influenced by other people who appear to have it made compared to me. But I was like, you can't avoid that, Sean. You live in New York City. Wealth is like right in your face. So we can't remove triggers because we can't predict how life is going to turn and how it's going to put us into a pressure point. The reward is actually also not going to change as much because ultimately the reward is for you to feel better. But for you to feel better over a longer period of time instead of just a temporary fix. And to change that, we almost have to be counterintuitive in our action. So the three examples, the first person who impulsively buys something when they feel stressed out. Actually, when you feel stressed out, the trigger, your action is to figure out what is it that's stressing you and how can you reduce the impact of that stress. For some people, it is actually literally like not doing the thing that's stressful. But let's say it's something that's constantly ongoing. Like for me, parenting is very stressful because I've got young kids. Then it's okay. How can I build a little bit more recovery time into my day to decompress from being overstimulated, for example? Then it's very less likely that I'm going to let my anger and frustration bleed out into the financial aspect of my life. And then so your trigger is that pressure point. Your action is to do something that really addresses the underlying pressure point. For the adverse event person who got triggered by a bad work review, I do recommend that most people with adverse events do go through therapy because you have to understand what is your childhood trauma and what is it causing your brain to say to yourself a lot of lies. I mean, there's a lot of lies that we feed our brains. And for a reaction to a bad work performance or review, the first thing is actually to intuitively say, this is not a measurement of who I am as a person or how valuable or how deserving I am of love. And I think that's very counterintuitive to somebody from adverse events because oftentimes the bad work environment means, okay, I'm a bad person. So that's the first thing we're going to do is like undo that lie that you tell yourself. And then when you can actually believe that, okay, whatever happens out there, I'm still me and I'm worthy, then you're going to rely less on buying things or doing things that you hope would raise your own value because you're already valued. And then the long-term reward from this new action is that you love yourself more over time and you rely less on buying things or doing things to make yourself feel better. Last scenario, the scarce immigrant feels really scared of the current economic environment. The trigger is that's always going to happen. I mean, I've invested since W. Bush. Every president does something different to the economy. The action here is to not bury your head in the sand, but actually get educated. Like understand, okay, when this happens in the economy, it usually results in this. And then I can react to that. I can't, by myself, I can't change the president. Obviously, collectively we can. But what can I do in the moment to take advantage of all everything that's happening? I often look at Warren Buffett because he's always saying, when others get greedy, you get cautious. And then when everyone is cautious, you get greedy, right? What he's saying is look for the opportunities, adjust your behavior as the environment changes. So the scarce immigrant gets triggered by the economy. Their action is focusing on things that can really move the needle. So whether it is putting more money into investing or getting, you know, a good raise at work, whatever you got to do to get yourself more savings and then getting the savings invested to buy yourself wealth. And then the resulting reward is financial freedom. And when you have financial freedom, you're a lot less to be affected by the day-to-day shenanigans that happen on the stock market.
Yeah. Yeah. I love those three examples. What I think of as I hear those is my care creates contentment phrase of when I have something that I am discontent with, instead of responding to my initial inclination, which is, well, I have to upgrade it or I have to replace it with something that I like better. Instead of doing that, I'll use my couch as an example. If I look at my couch and I think like it's gross, it's old, it's broken, it's whatever. If I believe that the action that I need to take based on that trigger is to just abandon the couch and buy a new one for $2,000 and then it'll look like Pinterest and then it'll be all these things, it will temporarily be that way. But what am I going to do when that $2,000 couch breaks instead of the $400 couch breaks, right? It has such a limited shelf life of happiness. And so what I've started to ask myself, which is almost word for word for, with what you've said, is what is the feeling that I'm trying to chase? And how can I achieve that exact same feeling in a wiser way? So for me, that looks like instead of buying a $2,000 couch, I bought a $100 little green machine. And when I'm discontent with the couch, I use that and I wash the couch. And lo and behold, I actually do feel differently about a clean couch than a dirty one. And
that machine is magic.
It is absolutely magic. I don't know how I was a parent for over 7 years before I got one. And I don't know how. I don't know how I owned any clothes, any furniture, any rugs. I don't know how I did it. I think it should be on every baby registry. but it has, using that, and then in the similar way, it's self-perpetuating, where when you do it once in on a negative habit, you're then more likely to do it a second time. The same is true with positive habits, that, you know, that first time we have that light bulb moment, that when I care for something that I own instead of replacing it, I can then break the cycle of always feeling the need to upgrade and replace. It gets easier the next time. The second time we feel that discontentment, our brain actually has a point of reference to say, hey, remember how you took a half hour to wash out the van and then you were happy with it? Let's do that again. And so I think of that kind of mentality of how can I just put a little bit of time, effort, money into something I already own to avoid jumping into putting a lot of money into something that I actually have no business buying.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. And I also do want to be honest, making these more positive cycles happen in our head does take intentionality because our base brain psychology is that it always wants to retreat to the easiest, the shortcuts. Because when we're stressed out and when our brains are overloaded, it doesn't want to do any more thinking. Like, please don't make me think more.
Right.
So fighting that and changing your habit, changing your actions does take time, emotions, and you also may not necessarily see the good results right away. I love little wins. I love celebrating little wins, but sometimes it takes a bit longer time to see it. But I guarantee you guys, it is worth it because I've done it, but you got to hang in there for the first couple of times because it feels so counterintuitive.
And I think just describing it that way, like if we just know that that's how our brains work, then when that starts happening in our mind, we can actually say, oh, okay, this is what Sheng was talking about, where it feels scary. It might just be because it's new, not because it's bad, right?
Exactly.
But our brain just likes to say warning, warning, anytime something's unfamiliar. But if our past actions have not gotten the results we want, then the actions we need to take in order to get the results that we do want, they are going to feel scary because, like you said, our brain just does not like something that is new, unfamiliar, uncharted. We prefer the known, even if the known has those negative outcomes. So in this trigger action reward cycle, we can think of every little purchase we make as having one of those cycles, even if most of them are quite automatic. Our brain is kind of going through what are my options, which reward do I want to receive, and allowing that to inform which action we then choose. You said the action is the thing we need to change if we want to change the overall cycle. What do we need to specifically look for to know what is the better action? I know you mentioned that it really should address that root cause. We don't want to ignore those root causes and think that that will change it. So how do we identify, like with the impulsive shopper, how would they correctly identify if an alternative action actually will help break this cycle?
Yeah. Go back to your root causes. Like first, identify yourself with one, two, or all three of the root causes. Mm-hmm. And then what I actually tell most people to do is know when you get triggered. Like when you get triggered, actually, it's okay to sit and stew in the moment for a bit. Like you got to have your emotions. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to make you bury them. I want you to have the emotions, ideally in a safe environment where you can feel emotional security, which I know a lot of people did not grow up with. Once you let the emotions course through your body, it actually does add a shot of adrenaline to your body. So that actually has to happen. Most of the time, I would say, but put a timer to it. Most people feel better in about 2 hours. So try to have all of those negative emotions within the time span of a 2 hour. Set a timer on your phone if you want to. By the time the emotions have run through, your head clears, the adrenaline goes away, your brain retreats back into a safer, less like fight or flight kind of mode. And then it can actually analyze, regroup, think, okay, what just happened? What was I feeling? What can I do about it? If you came from the root cause of feast and famine, the action is about fighting the impulse. It's okay. Let me plan, right? Let me plan what it is that I want to do next. If this item is something that I really want, let me sit on it for 24 hours to see if it truly is a need or a want. If you come from adverse events, again, you know, sometimes schedule an emergency therapy session. That might actually be the first action is to let's work through what just emotionally happened if it was a really big one. And then also, I often love a action for adverse events is to say mantras, affirming phrases to yourself, because you kind of have to bring yourself and recenter yourself into a place where you love yourself first. I actually experienced this, not that I grew up with a ton of adverse events, but I had some of it. One of the worst job performance reviews I ever had, I had to bring myself a recenter by saying, Xiang, you are still really smart. Like, yeah, that was a really terrible review, but you're smart and you know how to analyze and you're capable. And I just kept saying those things over and over and over again, because that doesn't change with one performance review. So mantras. For the scarce immigrant, I think taking small amounts of risk is actually really healthy. So I often think about trainers, physical trainers, because oftentimes they're like, look, we're not going to push you into, you know, a boot camp or something really heavy right away. But can you alternate and change little habits, like take the stairs instead of the elevator going out of the subway? Or can you substitute in a little bit more protein into your breakfast versus the sugary pastry? Mm-hmm. So for the financial side of the scarce immigrant, what are tiny amounts of risks that you can take? Maybe instead of investing all of your savings, just invest a small amount. Get comfortable with the action and the feelings you have around investing, and then do it more and more over time.
So I love you when you talk about changing the action in the book. You also specifically mentioned taking a low-cost approach to solving the problem. So can you talk a little bit about why did you specifically add that qualifier into it, that it should address the underlying cause and be low-cost? What's the reason for that?
I would imagine that most people who are considering themselves quote unquote bad at money are probably overspending, trying to solve their root causes, their root issues. And yes, I acknowledge that therapy can be expensive, but there are ways to get it for lower cost. Because I also don't want to feed into you experiencing lifestyle inflation while trying to address the underlying issues, because I see that happen all the time. Carly actually mentioned this towards the beginning of the podcast, where you're saying how, like, we get happy with it, but then we want more. That's called hedonic adaptation in psychology, in that once we've experienced a, like, high from a certain experience, the next time to bring our brains up to the same amount of high, we actually have to spend more. That's why you find ultra high net worth, like the billionaires and their kids, just spending like crazy on things that really, like, a bag shouldn't cost, you know, $100,000. But some people just, they do that because that's feeding into that psychology. So by doing things low cost, not only do I get you to the same, pretty much the same amount of joy mm-hmm. as an outcome mm-hmm. because we're solving your underlying issue, but also I remove the temptation from your life to use spending as the solution, because it's not always spending. And then I save you money in the process, yes. which is fantastic, because then you can take that savings and get yourself to financial freedom.
Yes, yes. So the whole reason I asked that was because I loved it so much. I'm like, I love that she didn't just stop at address the underlying root cause, but it was address the underlying root cause in a low-cost way. Because I think that does, even if, you know, later down the road, as you've healed that cycle and changed how you behave, having that low-cost approach default just continues to serve you as you go on and as you're building that wealth. In the second half of the book, then you go through things that practically do build wealth, like having that emergency fund, paying off that high-interest debt, investing, and you do it in a way that continues to call back to these root causes. And I think that structure to the book is so helpful in it makes it fundamentally different than, for example, reading a book about investing that just jumps right in on chapter one on how to invest and where to put your money and things like that. Because without those root causes being addressed, we can't actually make those changes in long-term, sustainable, healthy ways. So I love that both of those things are in the book, that first half was really heavy on you have to do the mind work first. But then in the second half of the book, you do address the things that you have to put money in the stock market in order to get to a place where you are financially free and in retirement. But you don't forget what that first half, that those things are tied together and we have to address both of them in order to see that change.
I accompany that with real life examples from mm-hmm. actual people that I've worked with, because it is real. And as you see how they make their changes, hopefully you'll be like, oh, if they can do it, so can I.
Yes. Yeah. And you have stories of people who faced really hard things. Like, it's not just, oh, they had, you know, $2,000 in credit debt and a six-figure income, and so it took 2 months to pay it off. Like, you have people in here who had to walk a road that took a year, that took a long time in order to, you know, where 3 years down the road, they were like, okay, now I've seen that change and seen that growth. But I think the harder it was when you faced it as a child and in early adult, it's normal mm-hmm. that takes longer to then work through and heal from. And I wanted to close with page 71 at the end of a chapter, you were referencing to people as they work through some of their homework that they were supposed to write down what their triggers were, their action was, and their reward. You had this little quote that I just want to read because I think it sums up so well what the power of this book can be for people who are listening and for those who go out and read it. You said, I hope seeing these examples makes you feel less alone in your money journey, that you're part of a community of people worldwide who have experienced something similar to your life and they've acted similarly. Thankfully, this community is going to grow and prosper. I think in everything that we've talked about, especially with those root causes, because they're not normal conversations that just come up while you're chatting with someone, it's so easy.
Yeah, what's your root cause?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You meet someone for coffee and it's like, did you face any adverse childhood events? But because they don't come up like that, then it's easy to feel like we are the only one experiencing that. We're the only one feeling like that. And so what mm-hmm. you have done so well is created a community of people willing to talk about that. And you've spearheaded and said, if you're transparent about what you've experienced, it invites others to do the same. And I think that the more we can bring those stories to light, the more it provides community for those people and brings other people who probably would have stayed in the dark about it just for the sake of not talking about it to be willing to then talk about it and work through it, which I think is the power of that community social piece of it.
Yeah. On my book tour, I actually asked all of my audiences, I was like, how many of you guys heard money discussed in some way growing up? And in many, many scenarios, more than half of the room never heard it discussed. So it has essentially been a taboo topic for a long time. I actually think that's been changing with Gen Z and Gen Alpha, which is fantastic. I think the more that we bring to light something that is difficult, the less shame we all feel about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, Sheng, in addition to ordering your book, Wealth as a Mindset, and reading it, where can people find you, learn more about what you do?
Yeah, and because my name is a bit of a beast to spell, I chose the company name Save My Sense, as in cents and dollars. So I'm on Instagram, YouTube, and if you just search Save My Sense, you'll find me also savemysense.com. Just reach out anytime, ask me any questions, check out the book. It's really my hope to impact your life and change it for the better through the content that I create.
Amazing. And we will have links to the book and finding you on your website and on social media in the show notes as well. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Debt-Free Mom Podcast. If you want to join me as a guest on the show, go to dfmpodcast.com. The Debt-Free Mom Podcast is hosted by me, Carly Hill. Music for this episode was written by Kyle Hill. Hit subscribe wherever you're listening to join in with every new episode as we grow our confidence and contentment in our personal finances.